You're tuned to Radio Prague with a special program to mark the feast of the great early 15th century religious reformer Jan Hus. As they enjoy the day off work on July the 6th, most Czechs give little thought to the man behind the holiday. In fact, it's a rather gruesome anniversary we're marking on July the 6th, 1415, 595 years ago. Jan Hus, also known in English as John Huss, was burned at the stake as a heretic when he travelled to the southern German city of Constance. It was a spectacularly unsuccessful attempt to heal the growing rift within the Catholic Church over his work in Bohemia. His death was followed by the rapid spread of what became known as the Hussite movement, sowing many of the seeds for the Reformation in Central Europe. Jan Hus is also traditionally seen as a Czech national hero. Again and again he has been hailed as a symbol of the struggle for Czech self-determination. But his legacy is a complex one. In the course of the Hussite Wars following his death in the 15th century, acts of great cruelty were committed in his name. In more recent years, in the 1950s, Hus even came to be hailed as the first Czech communist. And there is the paradox of Jan Hus, the good Catholic, who became a symbol of the European Reformation. To talk about this fascinating and continuing legacy, and to mark Jan Hus Day in the Czech Republic, I'm joined by three Hus scholars, David Holton and Thomas Fudge, both of whom are from Canada. Thomas Fudge has just finished a book about Jan Hus, and David Holton teaches at the Theological Faculty here in Prague, and also by Peter Moret, who is originally from the Netherlands but has lived in Prague for more than two decades. Thank you very much, all three of you, for agreeing to talk to Radio Prague about Jan Hus.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you very much, too.
I suppose we should start with the very basic question, because it's a question to which probably quite a few of our listeners won't know the answer. Who actually was Jan Hus? Peter.
Most of us today might say he was a reformer or someone who was involved in reforming the church in the 15th century, a process that started already in the 14th century, and Hus was focusing at how to get the church doing what it should do, that is, take care about the people, giving pastoral care to those that need it, and to get the church rid of unnecessary interest in power and in wealth.
And so at the time, the Catholic Church in Central Europe was very corrupted, was it? Thomas Fudge.
Well, that's a perception that it was very corrupt. I mean, there was a lot of things going on in the church at the time, and as Peter has quite rightly said, Hus was concerned with reform. And more, I would say, moral reform than doctrinal reform. And the other thing to take into account is that he wasn't the originator of a reform movement in Bohemia. He was the inheritor of a movement that predated him. But he becomes a seminal figure mainly because of the manner of his dying.
David Holton.
I was simply going to add that I think it's always important to remember that Hus was a Roman Catholic priest. But it's also important to remember that the church is clearly a multinational, so that you can't talk about what's going on in Bohemia apart from the life of the church as a whole. And during this period, it's very important to remember a divided papacy, which creates great trauma among people because salvation depends on being in communion with the Pope.
So at the time, there actually wasn't just one Roman Catholic Church, but there were several rival factions.
There were certainly several people claiming to be Pope, and salvation depended on being in communion with the Pope, and if you didn't know which one, and in Bohemia, various factions were in communion or recognized different people as Pope.
Perhaps there is the point where Hus adds something in terms of doctrine, that is, that he tries to formulate a concept of the church that is less dependent on the Pope, who is actually recognized by this or the other part of the church, by saying basically that the unity of the church does not depend on the Pope himself, but depends mainly on the community. So he turns a little bit the whole thing upside down.
In social terms, I mean, this is very interesting, isn't it? Because he's talking about working within the community where you live. And I would like to ask you about Jan Hus, the man, and about the way he worked with his parishioners in Prague. It's well known that he preached from the famous Bethlehem Chapel here in the center of Prague. Is it well documented, his life as a preacher and with his parishioners?
Yes, it is. We have quite a number of extant sermon texts from Hus, spanning particularly the 10 years in which he preached at Bethlehem. We know from testimonies from some of his contemporaries that Hus really should be regarded principally as a preacher. He was a scholar, he was a number of other things, but he was a preacher concerned with the cure of souls, and we know that he gave himself to this task wholeheartedly with considerable devotion over many years, and it's interesting that even his most notable detractors never impugned the moral character of his life, nor his commitment to what we would call broadly ministry.
And there seems to have been something about Hus's character that attracted people's devotion and veneration. Another great reformer that antedated Hus was John Wycliffe in England, but there was never the same personal devotion to Wycliffe.
And how did he come to be such a strong symbol of the Reformation in Europe? Because obviously he was a reformer, but the Reformation was still very much in its infancy.
I think it'd be an error to classify Hus as a Protestant. I mean, Martin Luther goes so far as to say, well, we were all Hussites, and he includes St. Paul and even St. Augustine in that. And while I can appreciate the enthusiastic endorsement of currents and emphases of reform, Hus didn't preach classical Protestant doctrine. He is, I think, best described as a late medieval Catholic reformer. But the reformers of the 16th century were eager to find antecedents for their emphases, and Hus really fulfilled that role quite well for their purposes.
Hus's preaching in Prague drew a great deal of attention to Bohemia, a great deal of negative attention from the church, divided as it was. And this led directly to Jan Hus's rather grim death. David Holton, could you maybe tell the story of what happened?
Hus went to Constance to clear up the charges against him. He believed that he would be able to debate the issues. He was not. He was condemned for things which were falsely extracted from his writings. He would not renounce those accusations. He was therefore condemned, and on the 6th of July was burnt at the pyre.
Peter Moray, you wanted to add something to this?
To put it in a somewhat broader framework, Hus was not the only one who was concerned about the situation of church and society in his time. He also saw the church, let's say, as we have been saying, as a part of the problem. The Council of Constance was also a reform council, but had a different approach to reform, and obviously was broader organized. So the alternative was Hus. That was basically an alternative to the approach of the Council of Constance. So both were interested in the same thing, that is, the church as a part of the solution instead of the problem at that time. What happened was that the council did reject the option of Hus.
And Thomas Fudge, you've been taking notes here. I'd be interested. I think you wanted to say something.
Well, the thing to keep in mind here is that the trial of Hus did not begin when he went to Constance. It began in 1410. Constance was the second part or the last part of a legal process that had been put into motion by Hus himself, I might add, as long ago as 1410. And the charge of heresy was something that was extremely serious to the late medieval church. And Hus was guilty of heresy because, and principally because, he would not submit to the authority of the council, which the council itself had said it had convened under the aegis of the Holy Spirit, and even popes had to submit. And because Hus wouldn't submit to their authority, by the definition of canon law, he placed himself outside the church, and this led, of course, to his, as you put it, grim end. And indeed, that is what happened.
He was condemned and publicly burnt at the stake?
He was found guilty. He was executed.
As I understand it, the Council of Constance did succeed in the aim of healing the schisms within the Catholic Church, but the burning of Jan Hus led almost directly to war in Central Europe, in Bohemia, didn't it?
Yes, indeed. The reaction basically in Central Europe was that we were condemned in Constance, and we, with our reforms, we are on the right path, and Bohemia is going to be the place where even Christ is about to come back. And you had this kind of huge expectations in the following years, leading to all the battles, the Five Crusades, a period of great chaos and indeed a lot of destruction on both sides, by the way. The Crusades did a lot of evil, obviously, in Bohemia, but then you also had the raids of the Hussites into Germany, the German states, where they also did quite a lot of harm.
Yeah, the death of Hus clearly led to the Hussite Wars, as Peter has said. And I would go as far as to say the Hussites themselves saw all of this as a prelude to Armageddon, the actual end of the world, and Hus is kind of a hinge upon which Bohemian religious history turns in 1415.
The symbol of the Hussites and of Hus to this day is the chalice. This is of great significance, isn't it? Peter, could you explain why?
The chalice became the symbol of the Bohemian Reformation because already in the time when Hus was still alive, but already in Constance, the Eucharist was for the first time in Prague then celebrated under both kinds.
So both the bread and the wine.
Indeed.
In the tradition of the Church, receiving both bread and wine was the universal practice of the Church for centuries, and for a whole variety of reasons that fell away. What's quite important here is that in the 14th century, there began a movement to once again restore communion as a frequent practice, because the average person received communion only once a year. And the restoration of the chalice was effectively a consequence of the restoration of frequent communion. People received communion. You produced a whole bunch of biblical, patristic, medieval proof texts for why you should receive communion. And from those texts, it suddenly became clear that it was not just about bread, but it was also about wine. So what was going on in Bohemia is probably, from the point of view of a liturgical historian, the most important Eucharistic movement in the entire Middle Ages. And here it worked, and it caught on. And I think because of that, because the chalice itself, in a sense, eliminates a certain separation between clergy and lay people, that the chalice quite easily takes on a symbolic role.
The chalice, it's kind of, to use a modern term, a religious democracy. No longer is it just the priest who is receiving the blood of Christ. It's everybody, including children and small babies. And beyond that, this social egalitarianism and receiving the cup, everybody together, priest and lay person alike, men and women, was a significant religious practice that the Czechs were prepared to die for throughout the course of the 15th century.
One thing that we haven't discussed at all is the close link between Jan Hus and Czech national identity. He is seen to this day as one of the symbols of Czech identity and of Czech history. And to what extent is this true, and to what extent is it a myth?
Well, of course it is a myth, but that's not the point. I guess it works. It's simply one of the concepts that, especially in the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, was quite successful. The symbol of all this is basically the statue on the Old Town Square in Prague, where you see a Hus, who is not a religious reformer, but who is a nationalist leader.
And I should point out that this is a very large statue that really dominates the Old Town Square, doesn't it?
It is a huge statue, and it is basically a statue of national resurrection. That's also the concept that's behind it. He's the leader of the people in his time, but he's also the leader of the nation in the 19th century, the 20th century. It was 1903 when it was revealed. And there he becomes then the leader of the nation, but on the cost of his religious identity. And that's, I guess, the very important aspect about Hus today. Hus in the Czech public memory, let's say, he is not in the first place a reformer of the church or faith or something or religious practice, but he is a reformer of the nation. That is to say, he is a national hero.
This idea of nationalism goes right back to the 15th century, to the period of the Hussite Wars, There's all kinds of allusions in the literature about being Czech means to be Hussite. Hussite is Czech. There's a problem with being a German Hussite, for example, in some of the literature. But it's in the 19th century with the National Revival and Palotsky, where he interprets the Hussite movement as a national thing, and the religious elements fall away. This is regrettable, because it is to make Hus in the image of something that he himself did not embrace and did not envision.
The turn is Palatsky's history of the Czech nation in Bohemia, Moravia and Silesia, where all of a sudden he does not see the history as the history of this territory, as a territorial history, but he changes that into a history of those that are on the side of Protestantism, as he calls it, and therefore Czech, and those that are on the side of, let's say, authoritarian Catholicism, and that's the German side. So there you have the friction in the full extent. And it would be wrong to say that 19th century, 20th century nationalism in Central Europe at large would be of the same kind as the 15th century.
Yeah, that would be entirely correct, except I don't think we should downplay the conflict between Germans and Czechs in Prague, in Bohemia, in the later 14th and 15th centuries. You have arguments about how preaching should be done. In fact, the Bethlehem Chapel is founded in 1391 specifically for preaching in the vernacular. That would be Czech. And there's a lot of conflicts there where you've got Czech priests being booted out of parishes and replaced with German speakers or vice versa. And there is a lot of conflict, and Hus gets wrapped up in that. And it's arguable to what extent. I personally do not think he was anti-German, but politically and socially, it does remain a point of faction during his lifetime.
But there's also a passage in one of Hus's sermons where he seems to be refusing to get dragged into that, where he talks about, should I love my bad Czech brother more than my good German brother or sister? And says, my obligation is to love the good regardless of nationality.
And there is one other fascinating curiosity, I suppose, which is in the 1950s, in the early years of the communist regime in Czechoslovakia, where Hus was turned into a communist hero, wasn't he? I mean, even the Bethlehem Chapel, which hadn't existed for the previous 150 years it had been demolished, was rebuilt.
The communists needed to show that there is a continuity in their idea of history, that they are not, something implemented from Moscow, from outside. So when Zdeněk Nejedlý, the first communist minister of education after the Second World War, wrote a kind of small brochure about the Hussite period and about communism, he said, well, the communists are basically the inheritors of the Bohemian Reformation. And as a result, he said, well, Hus today would not be preaching on the pulpit in the Bethlehem Chapel, but he would be with us marching in the streets and speaking in the gathering halls where we communists are being gathered.
Moving forwards a little bit, I mean, to 1968, in the period after the Soviet invasion in 1968, there were a good few Protestant ministers, theologians, who were involved in the dissident movement in one way or another as well. So it wasn't just the one side, but it was also the other side, wasn't it? Peter?
It's very interesting to see that, for example, in 1977, when the document Manifesto Charta 77 was launched, it was signed by a number of theologians or ministers of several churches. I did some research there, and quite a few of them, when I asked them about their motivation in that time, why to sign the document, they went simply back to the Bohemian Reformation and said, well, this was what our ancestors did, so we had to do this at the same time.
It's very interesting. Hus took a stand for principle and lost his life. Some of these individuals we're speaking of just now took a similar stand, and it cost them in different ways. I mean, one of the great historians, František Šmahel, became a tram driver because he didn't buy into the ideas that were being promulgated. There were others who became church organists, and that's how they earned their living during the regime. And so the cost of commitment, the courage of conviction, I think for a lot of people from Hus right on down through different periods of Czech history exacted a very high toll.
We've been through 600 years of the history of Jan Hus, his legacy, how he's been interpreted. Where does he stand today? Obviously, he means something a great deal to the three of you. You've studied his life and work and his theology. None of you are Czech, which is interesting, although you've obviously taken a very close interest in Czech history as well as the history of Hus's theology. Where is Hus today, and what does he mean to you? Peter?
Well, I guess it would be fair to say that every time has its own Hus. The time of the 19th century, 20th century, communists, and so on and so forth. And even, let's say, the 1990s, with the rehabilitation process, we didn't mention that so far, where Hus became the symbol of reconciliation of the Czechs and somehow the Roman Catholic Church. So today we are at the point where we have to say, okay, Hus, in the research at least, is primarily someone who was thinking about how to see the reform of the Church, how to see the Church in its mission among the people. So it's much more a theological debate today, what we have to have on Hus, than a political debate or a debate of a social kind.
I think that Jan Hus must be seen as a great Christian, a follower of Jesus Christ, a faithful martyr, someone who was concerned not with the destruction of the Church, but with its reform and reformation. And frankly, 600 years after his death, I personally find him a great inspiration and a man whose life speaks volumes to us, even in the 21st century, about truth and integrity and principle. And these are lessons I think we would all do well to learn carefully.
And also the price that sometimes you have to pay for sticking to your principles.
Absolutely. I think there's always a price to be paid when one stands up for principle, because often when you do that, you find that you're going to be standing alone. And at Constance, apart from the comforting handshake of one of his colleagues, Hus was alone, and he died alone.
David Holton.
I think as token of this, it's significant that the feast of Hus has appeared in the liturgical life of more and more churches. The Episcopal Church in the United States, for example, put him on their calendar at their General Convention last year. But year by year, Anglicans, Lutherans, Presbyterians, Methodists, in their regular cycle of commemorations of holy people, remember Hus. And he's held up as a reformer of the Church, a renewer of the Church, and somebody who is an example of faithful witness to Christ for all times.
David Holton, Thomas Fudge, Peter More, thank you very much indeed for talking to Radio Prague for this special program to mark Jan Hus Day here in the Czech Republic. From me, David Warren, and all of us here at Radio Prague, goodbye.